Hello and welcome to the Student Loan Planner Podcast. I'm Dan Rooker, a consultant here, and with me we have senior consultant Lauren Williams. Lauren, how are you doing today?
I am doing wonderful. Welcome to May, everyone. I am so excited to do this show with you today, Dan.
I am too. May's a month to celebrate a lot of things. You've got the holidays, Cinco de Mayo, Mother's Day, as we're recording this, just happened, Memorial Day at the end of the month. I was looking up some things recently about other reasons to celebrate this month besides my birthday. And there's like foods to celebrate. American Cheese Month. I didn't know that. Did you?
I did not know American cheese was something we should be celebrating.
Right. I celebrate whenever it's on a burger, I guess. But National Asparagus Month is another. Lauren, Molly, and Megan did a recent podcast for mental health awareness for the month of May. It's also Jewish American Heritage Month. It's also Asian American and Pacific Islander Heritage Month. That's our focus for today, especially with what's been going on earlier this year. Our headline for today is the model minority myth. We're going to talk about that. I think it's important to discuss on the podcast. So, Lauren, if you could just run us through an overview of what we're going to talk about.
Just one thing before we get started. These holidays, you kind of brushed over one. You're like, oh, and I was also born. So when were you born, Dan? So everybody can send you emails and gifts and chocolates.
I was born May 2nd. I'll leave out the year. I was born May 2nd. I think celebrating birthdays is, for me at least, I've never been like a big birthday celebratory person. My wife is teaching me that it's important to celebrate your birthday. She loves to celebrate hers. It's like birthday month for her.
She's like me, exactly, where I love, it's like a national holiday. In fact, my birthday actually became a national day of mourning, so it is really a holiday now, but yeah. In the wrong direction. I am a 9/11 baby, so.
Oh, man.
Happy belated birthday to you, Dan.
Thank you.
And now we'll head back to the show. So the model minority myth. So you all might be wondering, how is this going to tie into student loans? And if you listen to quite a few episodes, you know we don't shy away from those hard to talk about subjects. Travis has done a lot of talking about cultural diversity. Him and I have done some podcasts on things that happen in the African-American community. And we will get to how this all relates to student loans. But, you know, the first thing I think we need to do is get a better understanding of what the model minority myth is. So that's going to be one of the first things that we tackle. And, you know, just to give you a brief summary, it is a set of assumptions about Asian American behavior that has held Asian American back as a culture. So we'll dig into that a little bit more. The second thing we'll be talking about is the cultural beliefs and the stigmas and how those things affect their career choices, student loans, and costly education decisions in the Asian American community. Then last but not least, we are going to talk about who this affects. And at the end, we'll wrap up letting you know what we can do as a society to help bring awareness to this topic. So Dan, do you want to tell us a little bit more about the model minority myth?
Sure. So I'm just going to turn that phrase around a little bit. And instead of saying the model minority myth, the myth of the model minority, that's a stereotype for Asian Americans. I've experienced this. It perpetuates a narrative that Asian Americans are math and science whiz kids. We're musical geniuses. It characterizes Asian Americans as a polite, law-abiding group. They've achieved the American dream through some combination of their talent and hard work. And my father is white and my mother is Filipino. And I grew up in a, we'll call it a lower middle class environment. And for the most part, I didn't experience some of the stereotypes that come along with being Asian American, maybe perhaps because of how I look, or maybe perhaps because of the demographics where I went to high school or where I went to junior high. But I have experienced some stereotypes as I've gone along in my adult life even. And now that I think there's more awareness around it for myself personally, I'm able to interpret some of the things that I hear around me said about me in a different way. So it may sound positive to be the, I guess, the quote unquote model minority. And that may sound like a good thing. It may seem weird to take that as that compliment as positive, but it's counterproductive. It's counterproductive for not just Asian Americans, but all minorities.
Yeah. As I listened to you, Dan, I think you brought up some really good points about this idea that we are all very different. So you said, I didn't experience those various stereotypes. I didn't experience these particular things. And it may be a result of this. It may be a result of that. What we ultimately need to, you know, recalibrate ourselves to be thinking about is that there are 330 million people in America, and each and every one of us is different. And I don't know the number for how many people there are in the world, but each and every one of us is different in that regard too. And so we get into really dangerous territory when we start to lump people together as groups and start to shift and say, hey, this group of people, blah, 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 fill in the blank. And this group of people is XYZ. To put these labels on people in general is a thing that is counterproductive. So thanks so much for bringing that up. Okay, you were getting ready to say something about, I think, cultural beliefs and stigmas.
Yeah, so we just defined the model minority myth. That's what it is. Let's talk about stigmas, some stereotypes, and cultural beliefs and how these play into the model minority myth. You know, something that I've heard before, I took it more as a challenge than anything else, but I've heard the phrase tiger mom in the past. Have you heard that before?
I am not familiar with the term tiger mom. That is not a thing. Yeah, tell me more about this.
Tiger mom or tiger parent or tiger parents are defined as parents who push their kids to achieve excellence. We'll call it excellence, where it's looked down upon if you can't achieve the best. You can't be the best. So take that into grades, take that into whatever you're pursuing, athletics or music. And your tiger parent is, they're basing your success of your future on how you succeed today. So there isn't a lot of room for failure or average performance. So I think like where that can be not so great is when that's the expectation at home. And that might even be the expectation because of how you look at school, coming from the standpoint of your teachers or peers, and you don't achieve that. And there isn't a lot of support emotionally for when you fail or when you don't achieve, when you don't reach those expectations.
Yeah, I'm listening to you. And while I never heard the term tiger mom, as you talk about like how somebody might experience that when they go to school and the pressures that they're feeling from the home, I think about, you know, myself and my upbringing as a child. And one of the things I might have done to contribute to the stereotypes and to hurt, you know, a fellow Asian American student. We definitely, when I was a kid, ran around, and I don't know if you've ever seen the other kids pull their eyes and say, oh, I'm Chinese, you know, look at me. And there was even like back in my day, I don't know how long ago this is for everybody else listening, but Lady and the Tramp, there's this song that the Cats, and they were like, we are Siamese, if you please. And we used to run around singing that song, pulling our eyes, but we would change it to Chinese, if you please. And, you know, where did I get that messaging from? Where did I get that narrative from? And what effect did it have on, you know, the students that I interacted with or people that I came across? Because I could tell that they were different than me. And I think that's a hard thing for people to say, especially as an African-American woman who has, you know, definitely come across various types of stereotyping, racism, various stigmas throughout my life, to listen to you talk and say, oh, my goodness, look what I did as a kid. Look, I'm also guilty of this. Yeah, I don't know if there's anyone listening that realized they may have done something damaging, but I think that's a big step in making changes.
And it's easy to, when you're the recipient of something like that, where, you know, say, like, I can remember back to when I was a little kid, and that kind of thing may have happened. I isn't burned in my memory because I don't hold grudges. I was taught to just, you know, if it was negative, to sort of let it brush off and move past it. But even in the moment, my way of dealing with something like that is to laugh along with the crowd and to conform to the expectation of fitting in. And fitting in comes in different forms. And that creates, I think, beliefs from the inside about your identity. And I think that I was blessed to have been raised in a positive environment. And I would say that a lot of my expectations for excellence came from simply wanting to be a good example to my four younger siblings and excelling in the class and excelling on the field and in the pool was more of a competition among siblings. But it doesn't change, I think, a lot of the mainstream expectation and cultural beliefs of being Asian American and what it means to not, quote unquote, waste the sacrifice your parents or grandparents made in coming to the United States as immigrants. So those beliefs from the inside, I think one of that I would call out is A is for average and B is for below average. That's one thing that I think a lot of younger Asian Americans, kids can identify with in terms of the expectation from their parents. And then in the workplace for perhaps millennials, being tapped on the shoulder is instead of asking for promotion, feeling only worthy of being promoted if you've worked hard for it is sort of a innate belief system that I've experienced or seen in the community around me.
Yeah, some of the things I've heard expressed too are not feeling comfortable asking for that promotion. So to feel like you did the work, to believe that you have been kind of busting your butt, but that you have to remain quiet and shy and kind of fit into a stereotype of what people believe, and not feeling confident to go in and say, hey, you know, I've met all of the parameters that were set and, you know, even exceeded them. When is my time? And, you know, you're kind of counting on the person that you're employed by to do the right thing, but you're kind of harboring some resentment inside because you're afraid to ask for that promotion. That's something that some of the people that I interact with have shared with me as one of the barriers to these feelings and these beliefs and all this damaging social messaging that has come their way.
And I think these beliefs drive a wedge between other minorities, because it's sort of, if you believe that A is average and B is bad, then you're sitting there and going, well, that's just what I'm supposed to do. And then other groups may think, well, that's what I need to do in order to achieve success or achieve the American dream. And that's just not like a belief system that promotes minorities as a group. It separates us.
Yeah. And I can't imagine the amount of pressure you must feel if A is for average. And I'm like, well, what letter are we going for here? And if, you know, if there's this intense need to excel and exceed and do all these different things, and, you know, you're not necessarily interested in some of the stereotypical boxes that you've been put in, or, you know, just to know like, oh, I am completely over here. This is, you know, what I'm interested in. It doesn't line up with the level of intellect that people expect me to have. Like, that in and of itself is like this constant conversation that you're having inside. And, you know, how do you get out of that? Like, it's tough.
The other thing I think that, you know, maybe it didn't prepare me for how to deal with failure in a way. I will say this. So early on, success came sort of easily to me. And the first time I truly failed myself personally was in college. I had great grades in high school. I had great grades leading up to that. I was a star athlete from the, you know, relative to my peers. And then I got pretty bad grades. I got the B's and C's my freshman year of college. And it was a moment of awakening for me. And I had to deal with what I perceived to be failure. And it was really tough. It was one of the most difficult things I think I did, was accepting that I'm not going to just soak everything up like a sponge and learn it easily. But I think that if I had learned how to deal with, how to move past that sooner in life, that maybe it would have been different in college, and maybe high school would have been a different story, and I would be stronger for it. I don't regret the path I took, but I can see where that could make or break someone in college. And college is the place to do that for some people. But I could see a different version of myself not having made it through college because of what I experienced my first year of college.
Yeah. And imagine like adding those emotions, those feelings to a boatload mountaintop of student loan debt, which we're definitely going to get to momentarily. Like you said, we know that this is the Student Loan Planner podcast, and we definitely got some student loan stuff coming down the pipeline. But all these things are intertwined. They matter together. We can't look at any one thing in a silo. And so I think, you know, before we kind of get to talking about the student loan part of the things, we need to talk about the stereotypes. Are there some things that you've thought of or heard of that are, you know, stereotypes that people are experiencing?
Yeah, I think a common stereotype that people experience at many points in their life, early on or even in the workplace, is something that's usually not said out of spite or hate or anything like that. It's just an expectation. It's, you're Asian, you're supposed to be smart. And you can't be angry at someone for saying that, but I think it deserves, perhaps now in the state of mind that I am now in my awareness today as an adult, I think it deserves to be challenged. You know, just ask, what do you mean by that? And to understand and keep an open mind and have a discussion. You may not convince that person that being Asian means you're supposed to be dumb, but you can at least bring some awareness to that statement. I think another one is, I've been asked, where are you from? Or where are you from originally?
Right. It's like a follow-up question to the, like, no, really, where are you from?
Yeah. I'm from Oregon. Right. Where are you from originally? I think that's a topic that it's probably better if you're the person asking that question to just see if there's a better question that you can ask that is relevant today, is relevant to getting to know that person better today. You know, if you're curious because they look ethnically ambiguous, okay, ask the question, but make sure that you're asking it from the perspective of just, like, I feel like if I ask this question, it's going to enhance the conversation. It's going to lead to deeper meaning in the conversation and getting to know that person better, not separating them from the group and reminding them that they're different.
Yeah, this is an area where I am definitely convicted because I know I have room for improvement. There's so often, even in networking events, you know, people go to the, you know, what's your name? What do you do? And then the where are you from sort of deal. And I've been challenging myself to say, you know, people are not what they do either. By you being a physician or a dentist or a lawyer or a, you know, social worker or a teacher, what you do is not who you are. And so if I'm actually interested in getting to know someone, what can I ask that is going to allow me to get to know them? Those things are information. It's data that you can collect. But is it, like you said, the most important thing? And what exactly do you mean when you're asking it? And it's like you said, sometimes we don't know. It's like, oh, no harm, no foul. I didn't mean to say it like that. But, you know, one of the things I used to say was, you know, OK, it doesn't sound good to say, where are you from? But maybe if I ask somebody more politically correct, like, what's your ethnicity? You know, and sometimes I was met with, oh, thank you for asking in that way versus, you know, some other way, because people, like I said, that, oh, no, really, where are you from? And when I've been on the receiving side of it, I'm, you know, African-American. Well, my dad is Trinidadian. My mom is Black from Detroit. I have dreads. And so people assume a lot that I'm from the Caribbean or from some part of Africa. So I say, you know, where are you from? I say Pennsylvania. Like you said, Oregon. And they're like, no, really, you know, you don't have Caribbean descent or you're not from some part of Africa. Like, and they have that same follow-up question. But is it truly appropriate to say the where are you from versus what else could you learn about me that's more important than that in that moment? And also when you talked about like being smart, I was like, oh man, definitely have done that. And it was more so, like I said, but where did you get the messaging from is what we need to challenge ourselves. So you're Asian, you're supposed to be good at math. I definitely heard that somewhere in my childhood growing up. And I've definitely said that out loud to someone. And I'm appalled, you know, like you said, to reach this level of awareness and to grow and challenge myself. But I have to admit that I've said things like that. Where did it come from? I think is the area that you first have to reflect on. Like, why am I asking these questions? Why am I not thinking of a better way to describe people than to say where they're from? Why am I not thinking then beyond who they are or spending a moment to get to know who they are other than saying, hey, someone told me you're supposed to be this. So I'm going to go say this and think it's funny or a cool way to start a conversation versus being really thoughtful about how I want to converse with you.
Right. Yeah. I think that it's important to think about what you're saying and it's situational. It depends on who you are and who you're asking. It might be easier to ask that question, that last question beyond what do you do or what do you like to do? Or how does work make you feel to asking where that person is from? It's situational. I think that with money, it's easy to, or I guess better to think about money and money decisions. When we at Student Loan Planner talk to people, we're talking to them after they've made a financial decision about what they borrowed or what they've spent and made. And I often bring consults to at some point in the conversation about how it's important to just make a decision from here forward and instead of dwelling on what's been done in the past. And that's how I take my thoughts on how I've been raised with stereotypes and how I've experienced or conformed to the community or communities around me is that if I've made mistakes in the past about what I've said or who I've been or how I've thought or conversations I've joined in on simply to fit in, that I have an opportunity to make better choices today moving forward, both in how I carry myself and who I talk to, but also in a related way with my money as well. So speaking of money, I think the next topic we're going to just cover here is career choices specifically for Asian Americans. Lauren, when you think of a career for Asian Americans in terms of where we see a lot of Asian Americans working today, which may be a result of how they were raised or what they chose. What careers come to mind for you?
I think this is a really good question to ask our listeners. So you're in your car, you're on your run, and you're thinking, shout out what comes to mind. Before we say something, what immediately comes to mind for you when you think of how Asian Americans choose their careers? What careers are you mostly seeing Asian American people in? All right, enough pausing there. So for me, to go along with some of the things I've heard over time, I think of technology, STEM programs. So that's the science, technology, engineering, math, and then also medicine, that are those like high achieving, very hard, that require a high level of intellect sort of careers. So those are things that I have come to think of.
I think those choices, those career choices, are a direct result of upbringing. When you're taught by, for lack of a better description, since we already defined it, tiger parents, to achieve as high as you can go, some things that may go along with that, that start that process, is don't make any big life decisions until you go to college. You know, you can't start your life, start a family until you finish college. And then, or until you finish graduate school, until you've gone to law school, until you've gone to medical school, because doctors and lawyers and engineers, those are the people who make money. And I think a big reason why that is pushed in Asian American culture is that those tend to be higher paying jobs. Those tend to be jobs that allow you to do something that is also prevalent in Asian culture, and that is taking care of your relatives, taking care of your parents and grandparents, and giving back to those people who gave so much to you, who sacrificed for you. So I think some of these decisions around careers have less to do with what you love and more to do with what is going to be a better return on investment. But that tends to ignore something that is now important today, and that is the cost of education. The cost of getting a degree in engineering or becoming a doctor, becoming a lawyer, that the cost of that tends to be very high on average today, and higher, much higher than it was 20 years ago.
Yeah. And I think the thing that stands out to me as I think about this is, as it pertains to student loan debt, what if you are the first to go to college? What if you are the first generation to be born in America? Those sorts of pressures and things that exist around not having the resources because the person who brought you up and raised you didn't have to navigate this system also leads to yet another layer of, oh, I didn't realize I needed to save X number of dollars for my child's education. I don't know how to fill out this FAFSA form. I didn't know, you know, there's just this level of things that have, you just can't know because the person that came before you, even though they mean well, didn't have the resources to share with you. And so now you have this mountain of student loan debt simply because you didn't know that there were scholarships, that there were grants, or what else existed out there to be able to help you. So now there's an additional level of shame when you end up with this debt and you realize like, oh, I have to pay all this back. And, you know, maybe your family is very debt averse. And, you know, you also wanted to like live up to this dream. And maybe you're not even in a job that maybe you didn't even choose a career path that you like. That is a lot to have on your shoulders while navigating adulting, all the other things that come along with it.
I can relate to that, or at least my sister can relate to that. You know, I was the first person in my family, in my extended family, to go to college and finish college. Neither of my parents went to college. And so filling out the FAFSA for the first time with my dad for freshman year of college was an experience for both of us. Neither of us had experienced it before. And there wasn't a lot of know-how around when to apply for scholarships. Well, scholarship applications for a lot of first year students end towards the first semester or first half of your senior year of high school. And I missed that deadline simply because I didn't know it existed. And for my sister, she was a STEM major in undergrad and a very smart, much better than me through undergrad. And if she had simply applied for a STEM, for an engineering scholarship in undergrad, she went to an engineering school, she probably would have secured that as a woman in a male-dominated field at the time. And because of that, had to make some difficult decisions after undergrad to pay back more than six figures of student loans from undergrad. So I think about what could have been done differently. And I keep coming back to, well, the best thing to think about and dwell on is what can be done differently today forward.
Yeah. One of the things as you were speaking, I was thinking about another thing that I've heard quite a bit is that Asian Americans are doing so much better than the rest of the minority population. And so they are the equivalent of the superior as it pertains to minorities that exist. But, you know, your story in and of itself just demonstrates that, like I said, 330 million people in America, 330 million different stories. And so often we get all the time as student loan planner people who have six figures of undergraduate debt. So why that's relevant is most of the debt we consult on in the six figure range is graduate degrees, because you can only borrow $30,000 for undergraduate. So this undergraduate federal amount that you can take is very, very small, which should leave you coming out of school with very little debt. If you hear somebody say that they only have an undergraduate degree and they have six figures of debt, we already know that 60 grand, 70 grand of that is private debt. And it comes with a lot more restrictions than the federal debt. So imagine getting out of school with $100,000 of debt, entry level job at 30 grand a year, and 70,000 of it is private debt that they won't work with you. There is no income driven repayment plan. Now you're behind before you could even have an opportunity to get ahead. And those are the things I think that sometimes people don't know or understand about what people who come from tough backgrounds are experiencing.
And Lauren, I think something that is probably not too much that we can read into for this podcast, but I do think that we've been talking about Asian Americans as one gender, and well, I wonder, like, you know, listening to you and Lauren and Molly talk in a recent podcast about the mental health survey that we did in March, and seeing and hearing that 65% of the respondents were women, you know, if we could dig deeper, I wonder how many would identify as Asian American or Pacific Islander women, and how that would translate to life in the workplace with cultural beliefs as an Asian American, as a woman. That's like a whole nother discussion topic, I think.
Right, exactly. We can't unpack all the problems of the world today, but it is a very valid point. Amongst the various things that people are up against, like you said, especially as it pertains to mental health, is it affecting one ethnicity more than another? It's hard to say. Like you said, we haven't gone to get those breakdowns. But another thing I think of as I think of career choices is, you know, leadership positions and why that may be less common. So, you know, we kind of touched on it a little bit about maybe being afraid to ask for that promotion. But do you have any ideas about like what happens with leadership positions and, you know, how that can affect you in your career?
Yeah, I saw a YouTube video the other day about just some stats on Asian Americans. And they said that 60% of Asian Americans go to college and that Asian Americans make up roughly 13% of our workforce, but only 6% of our executive leadership positions are filled by Asian Americans. That's interesting to me because you have a very high percentage of the population going to college, getting educated. You have a pretty decent percentage of workforce professionals, prize of Asian Americans, but you have a very low percentage of Asian Americans in leadership positions. And I think that's probably perpetuated by a different narrative about Asian Americans, which is that Asian Americans are hard workers and easy to manage, and they're very loyal, or they follow company leadership. Because culturally, it's like I could tell you from growing up, like culturally, if my parents said no to something, it wasn't my place to ask why. It was simply to go and do that something or simply just take that answer as the reason for why. And that was reason enough. And I think in the workplace, there's this narrative that Asian Americans follow directions really well, but now don't necessarily know how to lead very well.
I think this is an important point to, like I said, pause. And as you listen, if you are in a leadership role and you have an employee that is a minority descent, and what you've thought about like why that person may not be able to head up and be promoted, is it because you believe they're too quiet, they're too timid? And is it a limiting belief based on ethnicity, or is it something that, you know, has some validity? And what can you do to encourage that person to come out of their shell and to be more open and to be more vocal and give them the tools that they need to be a better leader? So I always like to, you know, pair these discussions with action, because we have to hold ourselves accountable. Like you said, even earlier when I said like, oh, crap, I did that thing. I remember being the little kid running around like that's a thought that hadn't come to me in such a long time. But we have to own up when we're not doing our part and then think about how we can do things differently.
Yep. And leading comes in many different forms. You're exactly right. Like it comes from, there needs to be an open mind from the top down to redefine what leadership is or how leadership is done from the perspective of how that creates value for the company. But then it also needs to come from the bottom up, from people who want to be in leadership positions to learn how to use their voice, to learn how to be vocal about what they want and where they feel they can make the most impact. I know, Lauren, before this podcast, you told me about a consult you had recently about the perception of debt within Asian American culture. And I can say from my perspective that debt is something I wasn't taught was a means of getting ahead in life.
Yeah. So I've had two interactions that I'd love to share. And like you said, you know, like, this is not to say that this is how everyone is. If you've not learned anything from this podcast, it's that, you know, we don't put people in boxes, but two things that I have heard from Asian people that I've interacted with during consultations is one, a young lady where taxable forgiveness made the most sense. So she had quite a bit of debt and was not going to have income that was going to support being able to pay that debt off. And so what we do with taxable forgiveness is you pay based on your income, you save up for the tax liability that's going to come down the end. We call that the tax bomb. And it allows you to be able to save for a home and save for retirement and do some of these other things that are really important in your life. However, this young lady specifically said to me, you know, during the consultation, she said, I just really want to get this debt paid off. I have to get it paid off. In Asian culture, we don't believe in debt. It's already bad that I took this debt. And so I've got to figure out how to, you know, I'm just so embarrassed. I'm so ashamed and I cannot live with this debt. And she specifically attributed it to, in Asian culture, we don't do debt. So while I had a very good and plausible way for her to pay her loans off, there was something that was eating at her that she felt like culturally this was unacceptable and that this was a bad thing that she did. And she needed to figure out how to pay it off. Despite living in a high cost of living, she was in California place and going to be having a really hard time, like I said, based on the income that we were projecting. So that was one situation. And then, you know, another one was just kind of like a in passing sort of comment. Like I said, this is, you know, something you become more aware of in light of all the things that have been going on. But, you know, I was asking about, you know, why you chose, because they were saying that they did not like their career. And I said, well, why did you choose this career? What is it that you don't like about it? And it was like, I'm Asian. I have to do this. That's what everybody expected me to do. So I just followed suit and did it. But I actually don't like this. Those two things kind of stand out to me as like, you know, narratives that those people experienced that had led to, you know, big life decisions and then were impacting them majorly.
Yeah, absolutely. I think that when I think about the message we want to promote when it comes to these individual one-on-one consults, one of the messages maybe is that we're not out there to make you or force you to trust the system. And we recognize that people come in from different backgrounds and cultural beliefs around borrowing money. We're just there to ensure that you make an informed decision with what you have now. So to switch gears a little bit, just want to spend a couple minutes on who does it affect? What does the model minority myth perpetuate and who does it affect? It affects everyone. I'll start by saying that it affects everyone because if Asian Americans are the smart, hardworking minority at the top, well, that doesn't help other minorities. That creates this hierarchy that drives this wedge between other minorities and doesn't allow us to work together to accomplish things that are more important. It's a narrative that proposes that if you just fit in and work hard, you can be like the Asians. It also erases a difference between individuals. So I think even within Asian American culture, like this myth groups everyone as Asian, not Filipino, Japanese, Taiwanese, Malaysian, Indian. There's this grouping that shouldn't exist because there is a lot of diversity within Asian American people as a minority. And erasing that difference with this model minority myth causes so much harm. It doesn't do a lot of good, even though it sounds like a compliment. It also ignores the many different subcultures within each group. So for example, my mom is Filipino. There's over 175 languages and dialects in the Philippines. She happens to speak Tagalog, which is one of the main 8 dialects, but that tells you nothing. If she's grouped into this Asian American group, you couldn't even get down to her dialect and the types of foods that she likes or doesn't like. And I think that it's just this disservice to the culture of being Asian because I don't know what. It's not a good thing. Another thing that it affects, this myth affects within Asian American culture is this idea of being considered a foreigner and always an outsider. The perpetual foreigner syndrome, I think, is what I saw it called in doing my research on this piece. So some of this stuff I think has been enlightening for me. I've learned a lot. My eyes have been opened doing research and seeing how much this myth that I've heard about but not spent time thinking about, and in the big picture, how this myth is harmful to the struggle for racial justice. Because the success of some groups of Asian Americans suggests that if other groups would only work harder, have stronger family bonds, and get over the histories of oppression, they too would succeed. And that's just not, I don't know, Lauren, what would you say to that?
I mean, I think you're right on task. It's about the what can we do? And what you just mentioned was one of the things that you're doing. And I think it's so important that we share our stories. And that's exactly what I was learning as I was doing research. I was learning from the stories of others. So I have been able to share my story, and people have reached out to me saying how much it has impacted them. But if we all share our stories, it gives us something to go on. We know more about what people are experiencing, but we first have to look and find those stories. So, you know, for you and I, it's as simple as going to YouTube, and there's all sorts of information out there, and there are all sorts of people telling their story. So to share your story and to look at the stories of others, start doing that research, because it's mind-blowing the number of things that you'll encounter that you didn't know people were experiencing. Then I would say to keep an open mind when listening to the stories of others, because there's some information that you may hear that may be disturbing and maybe something that is against what you've known or believed up to this point. It may not be something that is particularly comfortable to hear, but it is so, so important to keep an open mind that what someone else has experienced, despite it being different from your experience, is real, it's relevant, and really important for us to all take into consideration as we have conversations and continue to interact. I'd also say that, you know, support groups, awareness groups, there's sorts of nonprofit organizations where you can participate and donate. You know, there's things like Stop AAPI Hate. That's something else that you can look into. And I think that we just really need to, at the core of this, to not let our identities be defined by stereotypes. So not to let those things weigh on us to say that we need to be this or that because this is what society believes that we should be, and to challenge ourselves to get out of that box, challenge that imposter syndrome, and be the best version of ourselves each and every day while we interact with others.
Thank you, Lauren. That was fantastic. We do want to get you all out on time for wherever it is you're going. So whether you're Asian American or not, you have student loans, you want a second opinion from any of us consultants, just go to studentloanplanner.com. We'd love to chat with you, hear your story, and help you out.